David Pérez García, Nova Church. And so we are working for a while already in a topic which is called projected entangled pair states, which is within a bigger framework of something which we just call tensor networks. And the idea of the talk is that I give a brief introduction about these tensor networks, specifically about these projected entangled pair states. And in a recent paper, this one here, we have made a connection between this framework and something that people are looking at in condensed matter theory, namely boundary theories and something that is called entanglement spectrum. So let me motivate a little bit the talk and also give you somehow what are the questions that we are interested in particular in the context of this talk. So as you know, I'm going to deal most of the time with lattice systems, spin systems on a lattice. So I will assume that I have a lattice which typically will be in two spatial dimensions, but it could be in more dimensions or in less dimensions. But I mean, to make things concrete, I will concentrate on two dimensions. And let's assume that we have a spin system, a quantum spin system on a lattice. So we can have spin 1/2, for example, or larger spin. So I will assume that most of the time we have spin 1/2, but at the end when I talk about examples, actually there will be bigger spins. So in fact, we can have here some states, psi, which will be linear combinations of all possible configurations, spins up, spins down, et cetera, et cetera. And so people have been considering this kind of problems. And so in particular, people have realized that if the states that we write here are specific ones, are their ground state of short-range interacting Hamiltonians, then they have certain properties. So, I mean, I will always have in the back of my mind that the states I'm talking about here, these many bodies, the states of this many-body system, are ground states or low-energy states of Hamiltonians, and these Hamiltonians correspond to some interactions between the spins, and these interactions are supposed to be short-range interactions. Okay, so it could be, for example, something like a Heisenberg Hamiltonian with nearest neighbor interactions, or maybe some other Hamiltonian, Ising Hamiltonians, in which spins interact with nearest neighbor, next near neighbors, and so on. And I'm going to consider ground states of that systems. And it's known, or it has been studied during the last year, something which is related to what happens when we take a piece of this spin. So now we have a ground state of our system, so we cool down our state to very low temperature, and then we take a piece, some region of spins, and we ask questions about how does this region look like. So you look at the reduced density operator corresponding to the spins of the system, of this region, sorry, this region which I call A. So it turns out that the states that are ground states of free body Hamiltonians have some specific, or seem to have some specific properties. And so one of these properties is what is called the area law, which basically tells you that if you look at the entropy of this reduced state, the entropy, if we make this region bigger and bigger and bigger, actually does not scale with the number of spins that we have within this region, which would be natural, but rather with the spins, the number of spins that we have at the boundary of this region. So we look at the entropy of rho A. This is case like number of spins that we have at the boundary of this region. So as you know, if I would take an arbitrary state in Hilbert space, not the specific ground state of a local Hamiltonian, and I would calculate what is the entropy of that state if I take regions which are bigger and bigger, and since the entropy is typically an extensive property, then this entropy will grow, will scale with the number of particles, the spins that I have in the region. But since those are not arbitrary states, but these are ground states of Hamiltonians of some specific form, then it turns out that they fulfill, or they seem to fulfill, something different, which is this area law, that the entropy scales only with the number of spins at the border of the region. So you may think that this means somehow that the number of degrees of freedom that you have in the ground state actually live close to the boundary because they scale like the number of like the number of particles that you have at the boundary. But that will come later on. Well, the second property that people have been looking at, so I mean there are some proofs of the area law in one-dimensional systems. You have gap systems, and can prove that, Hastings proved that. In two dimensions, there are violations of the area law, which are very mild because we scale their corrections that go like the logarithm of the number of particles for critical systems. In two-dimensional systems, even critical systems, some of them obey the area law, some of them have these mild violations, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of literature about that, but I'm just here making this remark about the area law. So another property that people have been lately looking at in some specific examples is what they call entanglement spectrum. And so it was Haldane and collaborators who took a sphere, so a two-dimensional system, two-dimensional set of spins on sphere, like 20, and they put some Hamiltonian there, whatever Hamiltonian. Then they look at the region of the sphere, so they cut the sphere into pieces, look at the reduced state of one of these regions, and then they say, so if we say that this is like a thermal state of some given Hamiltonian, so if I take my reduced density operator and I try to write it in this form, and so I take somehow the logarithm of the reduced density operator, and I look at what is this kind of effective Hamiltonian, and I look at the spectrum of this effective Hamiltonian, then it looks like, for the particular example that they look, as if it corresponds to a one-dimensional theory. So as you probably know, in one-dimensional theories, so you have a one-dimensional theory which is critical, then the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is given by the corresponding conformal field theory, and it has certain properties. So, for example, the degeneracy of the state, it's specific, et cetera, et cetera. So by looking at this spectrum, they saw that it has the spectrum as if it would correspond to the spectrum of a one-dimensional conformal field theory. So once again, it seems that when you have a two-dimensional system and you could cut a piece of that, then the properties of the bulk actually have like one dimension less. So you look at the entropy, it scales like if it would be one-dimensional system instead of a two-dimensional system. You look at the spectrum of this so-defined Hamiltonian, it looks like if it has one dimension less. And this is why people say, well, that's like there should be some kind of boundary theory in this two-dimensional system in such a way that the properties of the whole system actually are related to a boundary theory which lives in one dimension less. And I mean, some of the people say that this should be related to the holographic principle. But in any case, so this will be one of the motivations of my talk, and this is what corresponds to this part of the talk, entanglement spectrum and boundary theories. And I want to relate those observations to this projected entangled pair state that I will introduce now, and so I will make then the connection later on. So second part, what we call PEPS. And now we talk again about two-dimensional systems or three-dimensional systems, and imagine that we want to describe the states, the ground states of this Hamiltonian. Then since this Hilbert space corresponding to the spin system is huge, in the dimensions case like 2 to the power, the number of spins that you have here, it's hard to write it down. However, I mean, people have argued that in some conditions, so for example, when you have short-range interactions and you're at low temperature, then it should be possible to write the states in some specific form. Not so, in principle, you would try to write those states as a linear combination of some basis states. So this would be configurations corresponding to spin up, spin down, et cetera, et cetera. And this would be the most general state. So you would need the order of 2 to the n coefficients in order to describe a general state. But the claim is that if, again, your state is specific, so it's a ground state of one of these Hamiltonian, then it can be described in a simplified form, which is this PEPS here. And in the PEPS description, what you have is that if you have a spin system on a lattice in any dimensions, so what you will do is that you will, in order to write that, you will replace each of the spin by a tensor, And this tensor has, for the lattice, 5 components. So it has the number, the coordination number of the lattice plus one component. You write like that, one physical component, write it like that, and some components, alpha 1 to alpha 4. And in such a way that if you want to write this state as a PEPS in terms of these tensors, what you will do here is that you will write all these tensors, I1, alpha 1, alpha 2, blah, blah, I2, alpha 1, et cetera, I3. And then you would add, you would here consider, so each of the tensors, if you give this tensor, if I draw, for example, here the index alpha 1, the index alpha 2, the index alpha 3, et cetera, et cetera, and we have the next tensor here, then what you will do is that you will contract these two indices. So you will put here this tensor, you will substitute here the tensor, but the same alpha that appears here, this alpha here, you will make it equal to this alpha, and then you will add with respect to these indices, repeated indices. So you will have here a set of indices which will be repeated, and this is the way in which you describe these projected entangled pair states. So in other words, so it will become more clear later on. So in order to define a state with this language, you don't write here 2 to the n coefficients, but instead you write n tensors. So you have to give me n tensors, so the one that you will write here, the one that you will write here, the one that you will write here, et cetera, et cetera. These tensors have a number of indices, which is depends only on the coordination number. So it's the coordination number that you have in your lattice plus 1. So there is one physical index. So this is the index here, which is the one that corresponds to the spin up, spin down. And so the number of parameters, the parameters that you will have here will scale like your this index here runs from 1 to some number capital D. So it will scale like D to the coordination number. And if the physical index is, for example, spin 1 half, say 0, 1, then it would be something like that. So as I'm telling you later, I'll be a bit more concrete. But just to give you an idea, is that states which can be written as PEPs then can be expressed in terms of n tensors. And if you contract these tensors appropriately, this is how you write your state. Now, for example, go to one dimension, which this is much simpler. In this case, you can write, and let me consider from now on that you have a translationally invariant system, in which case all these tensors are the same. So you have a state in one dimension, then this tensor will have this physical index I and this auxiliary index alpha 1, let's say alpha 2. Then you will write this as a sum of AI 1, alpha 1, alpha 2, AI 2, alpha 2, alpha 3, AI n, alpha 1, I1, IN. So in other words, if I tell you which is this tensor, so for example, I tell you that A, 0, 0, or 0, 1, 1 equal to 1, A, 0, 1, 2 equal to 2, A, 0, 2, 1 equal to 1, 0, 2, 2 equal to minus 1, then the state is completely specified. So you want to know what is the component of your state corresponding to 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, so what is the coefficient with 0, 0, 0, then you put here a 0, a 0, a 0, then you contract all that, so you sum with respect to all repeated indices here, and then you will have the component of your state. So for the people who are not familiar with that, what it means is that by just giving you 4 numbers, I completely specify the whole state. Okay, I don't have 2 to the n, but I have just 4 numbers. And in general, the numbers that I will have to give you in higher dimensions, then it will be this number that I have here. And if all the tensors are the same, then it will be just this number here. It will be independent of n. Now, so, well, it's known somehow that if you have problems of this sort in one dimension, then actually if your system is gap or your system is critical, then there exists an efficient description of your ground state in this form. So this has been proven a couple of years ago. And so by the efficient description means that the dimension of your tensor, if you want to approximate your ground state, then we'll only have to scale polynomially with the number of spins that you have. In higher dimensions, this has been proven also for any finite temperature. It's a bit more complicated. You have to talk about purifications, mixed states, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole idea is that for any finite temperature, this is also true. The difference, though, between one and higher dimensions is that for one dimension, it turns out that this basically solves that the fact that you can describe your state efficiently with this tensor means that you can calculate all the properties, all the physical properties of your system efficiently, whereas in two dimensions, the fact that you can write your state in terms of this tensor doesn't mean that you can calculate things efficiently. So in other words, if somebody gives you these tensors in one dimension and you ask me, calculate what is the magnetization of my state or any other physical property, then I will have to calculate some expectation value, putting here some operator. And it turns out that this operator is local or is a product of local operators. This can be done efficiently. At the end, you have to calculate some trace of operators, which you can do in polynomial time. Whereas in two dimensions and higher dimensions, so the fact that you can approximate your ground state with these PEPs doesn't mean that you can calculate these tensors efficiently. So actually, well, for people who know that, what you will have to do in order to calculate the expectation values, you will have to contract a two-dimensional net of tensors, and this problem is very hard. Okay, so it's typically very hard. This is why algorithms in one dimension work very well. So now you want to use these tensors in order to build numerical algorithms to find ground states of particular problems, then in one dimension work very well, and actually this is the basis of what is called VMRG. Whereas in two dimensions is much more complicated because one has to find approximate methods in order to contract these tensors, and that's typically very difficult.
What specifies the number of lower indices on the A's?
Is the coordination number.
How many of them are there? Is that?
In one dimension, there are two, because I can have a neighbor on the left and a neighbor from the right. In two dimensions,
so it's as many as neighbors.
Exactly, as many as neighbors. With the lattice. It depends on the dimension and the kind of lattice that you have. Okay, now let me just give you a physical meaning of these projected entangled pair states, which is why they are called like that. And I have to jump to.
On the counter. It's on the table in front of you.
Oh, I see.
To the left. To your right. To your right. Straight ahead.
Oh, this.
Yes, yes.
I see. It's not perfect. Okay, I was looking at some kind of computer Okay, so the meaning of this projected entangled pair states, so you can introduce it or you can understand as follows. So imagine that you have a spin system as the one that I was drawing before in two dimensions. Then what you can do in order to create this state or to write this state is that you can make an auxiliary construction. So now you substitute each of your real spins by what we call auxiliary spins. Actually, as many as the coordination number, or something in two dimensions, four of them, like that, on each side. Now, you take maximally entangled state between nearest neighbor auxiliary spins, like that. So you consider an auxiliary state, which is very simple. It's simple and universal in the sense that I completely specify what is this state. These are spins just situated that I wrote them, and all pairs are in an entangled state, like that. Because in principle, the state here has nothing to do with the state here, because you have here some spins, mid side, and here you have four spins. So now, in order to make a connection, what you do is that you write a mapping So in each of these sites, you map the state of four auxiliary spins into state of your physical spin. So you write some map that takes this auxiliary spin, which lives in some Hilbert space to the power 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4. These are these four here. And each of them has a Hilbert space of dimension d. And then you map to the original spin, say C2. So what you do is that you, out of that, create a single spin. Out of that, create a single spin. And now, if I specify what is the map that you have to apply at each site, then I completely specify a state in the final Hilbert space, in the original Hilbert space. So one can show, it's very easy to show, that any peps can be just written in terms of these maps. So these auxiliary indices, or these indices that appear down there, you think a little bit about that, you will find that they are associated to each of these auxiliary particles, to the Hilbert space of these auxiliary particles that are there. And actually, if you write this map in a basis, so you write this map as some thing, alpha, beta, I, alpha 1 to alpha 4, the coefficients that you will write will be nothing else but these tensors. So that's the relation between one and the other. So you may think of this projected entangled pair state as if you have many entangled pairs, pairs of states which are entangled, like this one here, and then you project into a smaller subspace, each of them, and this is the way that you can think about. Okay, so now I will list the results that I will cover here in the talk. And which relate the two topics that I introduced. So the entanglement spectrum and boundary theories and these projected entangled pair states. So the first result is that actually if I have a projected entangled pair state, which we believe that represent well the ground state of any Hamiltonian with local interactions, and I cut a piece of it, then this piece of it, the reduced density operator, will fulfill the area law. And in fact, there will be, if I write the entanglement spectrum, it will correspond to entanglement spectrum of a one-dimensional theory. And actually, this one-dimensional theory will be a boundary theory and will be a theory for the auxiliary spins that live at the boundary of the region where I have cut it. So if I cut now something here, so I'm cutting the original one, and now I think about this representation, then I will have a theory which basically is describing these auxiliary spins that live at the boundary. In other words, so the boundary is equal to the auxiliary spins at the bound in the peps at the boundary. The second thing is that I will write, actually I will derive an isometry, so a mapping between your bulk and your boundary. So for each of these regions, you want, so as you see there are many spins here, there is an isometry, so something like a unitary operation, which will map like all my spins into these auxiliary particles that live at the boundary. So in particular, an isometry between the bulk in particular, if I write the reduced density operator of the bulk some region A, as I wrote it before, e to the minus beta h, for example, then it means that for the particles that live in the boundary, in these auxiliary particles which live at the boundary, then there will be a similar density operator, which will be e to the minus beta h prime, where this h prime is very much related to this h by this isometry, and in particular, the spectrum is exactly the same. Now, but this Hamiltonian here, I can really give an interpretation as a Hamiltonian acting on these auxiliary particles that are down there. And so what will happen on top of that is that this Hamiltonian H prime, for the cases that we have studied, actually is local. So meaning that it's acting, so it is an effective Hamiltonian for your auxiliary particles, and it acts locally. If you have a gap system with your system, if your original Hamiltonian is gapped, and so now you change parameters of your original Hamiltonian, or you change parameters in your tensor, so you change the state adiabatically, and you go through a quantum phase transition, then what will happen is that this Hamiltonian is not local anymore. So it reflects itself, gets not local or non-local in quantum phase transitions. Okay, so it's the way that it reflects. And if you have now a topological phase, so you can show that these PEPs also describe topological state, then you have a Kitaev, for example, toric code, then this Hamiltonian gets completely non-local, as you will see. And the last result is that actually this has a consequence for now the contraction of PEPs. So I told you at the beginning that the problem in two dimensions with these PEPs is that you cannot contract them efficiently because you have to contract tensors if you want to calculate some expectation value, and that's very hard. But it turns out that if this is true, so if this H prime that appears here is local, then as a consequence, this means that you can contract these tensors efficiently. Okay, so then it means that you can calculate expectation values efficiently with PEPs. Efficient expectation values. Okay. So, actually, this talk is not about proofs. So actually, there will be a proof of that, so this will be rigorous. I will write the symmetries. I will write down what is it. Now, this fact that is here, it's for examples. We have taken examples, we have studied examples, and we have seen that it occurs with our examples. So we conjecture that this is generally true. And if this would be generally true, then this would also be generally true. Yeah, that's the idea. Okay, so let's start talking then about PEPs, just making a couple of more remarks about them. Then I'll go and build this isometry, and then I'll tell you about what are the numerical results that we have and why this follows from that. Okay, so first, a little bit about PEPs. So I introduced them before, and so just let me tell a couple of properties which are important. So the first is in one dimension. I say that PEPs reduce to what are called matrix product states, and a way of representing this state, actually, so we have a way of drawing, instead of writing all the times all these tensors and contraction, et cetera, et cetera. So what we do is that we write a symbol like that instead of this tensor. And like tensors that appear here. Then instead of the tensor, I draw something like that. And when we want to contract these tensors, for example, if I have something like that, it means that I'm summing this quantity, then the result that I will have to draw is this tensor. This corresponds to the index I1. This corresponds to the index alpha. This is beta. And I have the other tensor, which is here, with an index I2, this index gamma. And if I'm summing on this common tensor and plus common index, then I will write it like that. I will draw a straight line connecting these two. So all these open indices are the open indices in my sum. This one here, this one here, this one here, and this one here, the ones that I'm not summing, and the ones that I'm summing in this form. Okay. So for example, so how do I write the coefficient Ci1 In of a matrix product state, which is what I wrote before. Just written in simplified form like that. Well, what I will write is tensor with this open index I1, then another tensor with the open index I2 up to IN. And then they are contracted, so they are like that, connected like that, and the first is connected to the last one. And so that's the way in which I draw this coefficient. Now, in two dimensions, I can do the same thing. So for if I have a two-dimensional lattice, and I say that to each spin, I associate a tensor. This tensor has an index I. This is the physical index, the index that is on top. So this I draw is coming out of the blackboard. And the other indices, I write them like that. So this would be a tensor A, I, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, where this is the index I. This is alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, et cetera, et cetera. And if I want to represent, for example, so let's see, what is this? I have four tensors. And so this goes like that. This goes like that. This like that. That's very complicated, but it's actually very simple. So it means that I have contracted all the tensor except for this I1, I2, I3, I4. So this would be something which I will write C, I1, I2, I3, I4. Yep. Yes, well, this example is periodic boundary conditions. If I would have open boundary conditions, then I would have here a vector and another vector. Later on, I will work actually with open boundary conditions. Yes, this is just to give a notation such a way that when I talk about tensor or matrix product state, I don't have to write all the time this, but I just can write this with this language, which is much better. Okay, so another property of these matrix product states and PETs is that actually you can always write, so you give me a PET, so you give me these tensors, I can always find a Hamiltonian, which is quasi-local, so which is acting on some specific region for which this is a ground state. Okay? So this is what we call pan-Hamiltonian. So you give me state psi, peps, then it's very simple to find a Hamiltonian H in such a way that H times psi is equal to E0 psi, and this is the minimal eigenvalue of H. Actually, in some occasions, it is possible also even to prove that this is the unique ground state of this Hamiltonian. So there are some conditions that one can impose in these PEPs on the tensors, such that this is a unique ground state of this Hamiltonian, and I will not need them here. But anyway, so this is maybe say, so in particular, if you have a state which one calls injective, because there is a map that one can define which is injective, then one can always find a Hamiltonian in such a way that this is unique ground state. And if the state is, if it turns out that some map that one defines is non-injective, then it turns out that there exists no Hamiltonian which is local for which this is the unique ground state. This is never unique. Okay, this will be important later on when I go through phase transitions, because when I talk about, I will talk all the time about PEPs, then this means that they are the ground state of some Hamiltonian, and if I change my PEPs, then out of a sudden comes that state that was injective is not injective anymore, so it means that whatever Hamiltonian we are considering for which this is the ground state has to close the gap, and therefore there is a quantum phase transition there. Okay, so let's come later on. Okay, so the next point is to talk about these boundary theories. So how to connect these PEPs to these boundary theories, area laws, et cetera, et cetera. And for that, I need a little calculation. So I cannot move. So two boundary theories for peps. Okay, so to be specific, I'm going to consider a particular system. So I'm going to consider a two-dimensional system with cylindrical geometry. So it means that you have two directions, the vertical direction and the horizontal direction. And so you have spins here, if you want, in this lattice. So these are spins. And as you see, this problem has periodic boundary conditions along the vertical direction and has open boundary conditions along the horizontal direction. This will not be important, but anyway, I will restrict myself to this case. So it will be translational invariant. And this I make sure, yes, because I will put exactly the same tensor at every place. I will consider peps, for which I will specify just a single tensor here, AI, with coordination number 4, so there will be 4 other indices. And we know automatically that that's the ground state of some particular Hamiltonian. And if this tensor fulfills some properties, unique, that it will be the unique ground state. If it doesn't fulfill, it will not be the unique ground state. And we know also that if you have a Hamiltonian with short-range interactions, there will be a state of this form that can approximate the ground state well. So now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to cut this system here in the middle. So I'm going to cut it into two sections. Section A will be on the left. Section B will be on the right. So if I look at the left part, so I will have something like that. Okay, this half of the cylinder, for example. And I will look now at the density operator corresponding to the spins living here. And this reduced density operator would be rho A, as I was telling you before. I take a piece of my system, and I can consider the reduced density operator. Now, if I talk about peps, then actually I could make the same drawing, in which I replace each of the spins but one of these tensors, one of the tensors that I have there. So you can have in mind as a cylinder, if you want, in which at each side there is a tensor. The physical index, so the spin up, spin down, is the physical index which is going out of the cylinder. And on top of that, they are contracted along the cylinder with each other as these ones are contracted here. And this is how I represent the state. And if you start contracting, so you see that at the end, there would be here a spin. And then there will be an index here, which when I have cut, is open. What here can give an index alpha 1. And for the next one, it is here. There is an index here which is open, alpha 2, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, what I'm going to write is first the global state using this language. And then I'm going to cut it, calculate the reduced density operator using this language. And what I will see is that this reduced density operator of the spin system somehow connected to a reduced density of these auxiliary indices, which are here. And this will be my boundary theory, which is related to the bulk theory. And I will build this isometry, which will map the states here to the states of the boundary. And that will be how I built all that. OK, so you see, now I will have to write very long formulas in which I will have to put I11, I22, all the physical indices here, all the auxiliaries, alphas, betas, et cetera, et cetera. But in order to make this task much simpler and to avoid bore you with a lot of notation, what I will do is that I will group all the indices into a single index, and then we'll have a simple derivation. So you see, I'll take all the indices, all the physical indices, I11, all the ones that are in region A, and I build a single index in region A, which I call capital I A. Then I take all the indices here of the spins corresponding to region B, and I call them IB. So if you want, this would be a basis for all the spins in a state. So here you could have spin up, spin up, spin up, spin up, down, down, and this up, 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 down, all possible combination. This is the 2 to the n Hilbert space. And now if I write this in the form of these PEPs, then I will have all these tensors which are contracted up to here, and here there will be these indices alpha that are on the border, and these indices I call all the indices lambda. And from the right, I will have the same thing now with the indices, which will be alpha 1, alpha 2, etc., which will be also lambda, and then I'm summing with respect to these indices. So what it means is that I can write my state, psi, the total state, as the sum with respect to these spins, IB, the sum with respect to these indices that are here in the middle. Then I'll have a coefficient here. So this would correspond to the contraction of all the tensors that are here, which will depend on these indices lambda and the index IA. So this is this here. Then there will be the same thing for the right, IB lambda. And then there will be my basis of states IA, IB. Okay, so that's the way, simplified way of writing the whole state, the whole PEPs, yes, considering just the contraction here in the middle. And now you can play a little bit with this formula. So, for example, let me write some other formulas, and I will not do the derivation, but it's actually very simple. You can write, actually, define a state for the left part, so including the physical indices and the auxiliary indices, like that. Where this is equal to the sum. And I use these rounded brackets here just to denote the auxiliary indices. These are the physical indices. So the state that I just wrote here would be a state that can be interpreted as the state describing half of the system, including these auxiliary particle auxiliary indices and the real indices. You can do something for the right as well. And you can describe what is the reduced density operator of the state. You trace the physical indices. So this I will call sigma L. So you trace these indices here, and this would be sum over IA of L IA. You can do the same thing for the right. Here for the right, and this would be this right. And you can also write here what is the reduced density operator of psi corresponding to the left side. So you can just trace these indices here. And if you do that, it's a very simple calculation. So rho corresponding to the left, so this is equal to the trace with respect to the region B of psi psi. Then you can write it in the following form. So sum of psi lambda prime times lambda square root of where I have defined those So we'll just, the claim is that just combining the definitions that I gave you, you can write this reduced density operator. And as you see, this reduced density operator, you write it in some basis, which is kind of defined in some strange way, times something, and this something, which is lambda prime here. And this something that appears here is nothing else but the reduced density operator of the auxiliary indices. So the reduced density operator corresponding to the physical indices is related to the reduced density operator of these auxiliary indices that I live here. And I wrote in this very strange way because it turns out that this basis is orthonormal. You can very easily show that if you multiply this by some other one, the scalar product of x lambda with x lambda prime is delta lambda lambda prime. And so with that, we have all what I wanted. Can we write this formula here, which is lambda, lambda prime?
What? A transpose, sorry. Okay. Transpose. Okay. Right, it's just transpose. Well, I mean, forget about this. It's a technical detail. So what it means, you see this formula. This is sum with lambda and lambda prime. Then you have here an element of the orthonormal basis. And here you have also, this is an element of the orthonormal basis, but in your auxiliary indices. So you can write an operator, u sum over lambda psi lambda times this lambda. And this maps from the auxiliary indices to the physical indices. Okay, so this takes something acting, let's say, on the Hilbert space of these auxiliary indices, and gives back something which is in the real indices. So it's transforming the boundary into the bulk. And in fact, since those are orthonormal bases, this is an isometry. And so what it means is that you can write now that rho L can be written as this isometry times square root of sigma L. I forget about this transpose, important, sigma right, sigma L, u diagram. So this relates, again, the reduced density operator corresponding to the boundary, to this, let's say, auxiliary particles that live on the boundary, on the left and on the right, to the reduced density operator of the bulk of the physical index. And now you take a problem with symmetries, actually. So you have, for example, that you have reflection symmetries, and you cut half of the cylinder. Actually, you can show that these two are the same. So this, in this case, so you have certain symmetries. What you will have is that rho L would be equal to this u sigma square L u diagram. Again, the reduced density operator of your bulk is connected by an isometry to the reduced density operator of your boundary. And this boundary, you can think of in this pair representation to these auxiliary particles that are behind the state, the ones that you project, as the density operator for these auxiliary particles. Okay, so in this way, at least for this pair, you can identify, when we talk about boundary theories, that we are talking about nothing else than these auxiliary particles that live at the boundary. Now, if you write this operator as e to the minus beta h, or e to the minus h, in order to talk about this entanglement spectrum, then this will be connected. So this h, or you write this as e to the minus h prime, let's say 2, then there will be the transformation between this one here and this one here, which is exactly this u. So this h will be equal to u, well, you write it like that, h prime. In that case, they will be related by the symmetry, so it means that they have exactly the same spectrum. So the spectrum of your bulk will be the spectrum corresponding to something that lives in the boundary, so something that lives in one dimension less. On the other hand, if you calculate
the entropy of this guy, that's something that is rather obvious, then the number of degrees of freedom that your entropy will have will be, and the entropy is independent of that, so it will depend only on the number of degrees of freedom that you have at the boundary, so we'll have an aerial corresponding to that. So now the next step is to say, well, so we have a boundary, and this, I mean, seems to be like a Hamiltonian acting on the boundary. So is this Hamiltonian local? So is this Hamiltonian like an Ising model or a Heisenberg model acting on nearest neighbor? And I mean, this is something that we cannot prove in general, but what we can do is to take some examples and solve them numerically, and track them numerically, and that's what we have done. So I'll tell you what are the results. And with that, I'll finish. Okay, so we have done numerics. And in the numerics, what we take is a model for which we know, so apparent Hamiltonian, for which we know what is the pairs, what are the tensors. Then with these tensors, we calculate this. Actually, we have an algorithm to calculate this reduced density operator efficiently. And from the reduced density operator, we take the logarithm, we calculate this Hamiltonian, and with this Hamiltonian, then we just write it as in a basis of operator. So we write this Hamiltonian H prime that we get as the identity, plus then if we have, for example, spin 1/2, then we could have here sigma x1 times identity, 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 plus sigma x2 times identity, plus sigma y1, so terms which act only on one spin. Then we consider terms that act on two nearest neighbor spins, so like sigma 1, sigma 2, and the rest identities, plus sigma 2, sigma 3. Then we take terms that act on three spins, sigma 1, neighboring spins, sigma 2, sigma 3, and the rest identity. Then terms that act on 4, 5, 6, 7. Then we calculate the coefficients. We add all the coefficients, and we call this was square, I take the square root. So this is what we call the 0. This is what we call the 1. The coefficients the 2. D3, and so we can plot now for a given Hamiltonian, for a given PET, what is D as a function of R of the index, R as a function of R, and if we have a local Hamiltonian, this means that we can stop here. So what we will find actually is that this decays exponentially as a function of R, so this terms become smaller and smaller and smaller. And if we go now through, and this would mean that we have a local Hamiltonian, and if we go through a phase transition, so what we will see here is that this is that, right, so you change the parameters of our PEPs, namely about the apparent Hamiltonian, then that we'll see that from something that decays exponentially, then it causes lower and slower, and at some point it changes from exponentially to long range. So you get something which goes like that, and this indicates the fact that you go through a phase transition. And actually, I don't have time to explain that with more detail, but just let me tell you what are the models for which we have done that. Well, and something that I forgot that is important. So this isometry does not only map the states of the bulk with the states of the boundary, but any operator of the bulk can be mapped into an operator of the boundary. So when you want to calculate some expectation value of two particles in the bulk, then you can calculate as expectation value of two particles in the boundary with the operator that you have at the boundary. So you transform all the physics of the bulk with this isometry to physics of the boundary, with a specific construction in which everything that is on the bulk can be calculated in the boundary. Of course, it's an isometry. So you have many degrees of freedom on the bulk and much less in the boundary. So maps is a map n to 1. So it means that there will be several operators in the bulk which you transform into the same operator in the boundary, but you cannot expect anything else if your theory of the bulk is represented at the boundary. But anyway, so what we took is some models. So one of them is called APLT, model in two dimension. So this is a Hamiltonian, which is two-body Hamiltonian for spin two particles in two dimensions, so I will write like that, the sum of H, I, J for nearest neighbors. like the one that I told you before, where this is some projector operator. And this Hamiltonian has the property that this is SU2 invariant in the global rotations, and also that it has an exact ground state, which can be written as a form of this PET, where this dimension d of your auxiliary particles is equal to 2, so it's the simplest one. So these auxiliary particles that you have to put in order to build the states are qubits. And what we have taken is also, well, this Hamiltonian in two dimensions is known to have several properties. So what we have done is we have deformed it. So we put here, we break this SU2 symmetry and make it dependent on a parameter, theta. And then we show that as a function of the parameter theta, there is a quantum phase transition. So this is why we can show how this interaction length changes as a function of this parameter, and therefore in a phase transition, and what you see is the behavior that I told you before. Then we have taken also a kind of an Ising-like Hamiltonian in two dimensions. So this is a Hamiltonian which actually has five-body interactions. Interaction has C2 symmetry, and also depends on a single parameter, and as a function of this single parameter, you can see a phase transition. So we observe exactly the same behavior, that whenever you're in a gap phase, your Hamiltonian, your effective Hamiltonian, looks like local. And we have studied also toric code, this analytically. And for the toric code, you can see that the Hamiltonian that you have is completely non-local. So the effective Hamiltonian is a product of sigma x, it's not local at all. And to finish, since my time is up, so I'll tell you what is the consequence of that into the possibility of contracting efficiently these PEPs. So if it would be true, this conjecture, that for all states which are gapped in the bulk, you have a Hamiltonian, you have the ground state, and imagine that the Hamiltonian is a gap, and imagine that you look at the boundary, and this boundary, you look at, say, at the reduced density operator of the boundary, it can be written as e to the minus h, where this h is local, so it decays exponentially, the length of interaction decays exponentially, then this would mean that you can contract these PEPs efficiently, and the reason for that I will just mention is that, so this part maybe for experts, a little bit more complicated. So when you have one of these PEPs, right, like that, in this form, and you want to calculate some expectation value of an observable, for example, two nearest neighbor observables, then what you have to put here is the operator. So you want to calculate, for example, cosine or alpha or beta. So operators acting on two different sides. Then you have to put here observable, and you put somewhere else your observable. This will correspond to this part here. So psi is the tensor with the indices pointing out. These are the observables. And then you have to put the bra, the other bra on top. So you see it from the top, but you will have here is another tensor that you have to contract. This is what I was saying before, that in order to calculate the expectation values, you have to contract tensors. So you can see that there is another tensor here, another tensor here, another tensor here, which are contracted. And if I see from here, I will see one on top of each other. So it would be double indices here, double indices here, double indices here, and so on. And the place where I'm calculating the expectation value, for example, here, this tensor is a little bit different because I have sandwich this operator in between. And this was different because I have sandwich an operator in between. So you will have to do this contraction. So you will have to take these tensors, contract all of them, and the way of contracting these tensors is to pop on here from very far away, start contracting, and you can show, very easily show, that actually in the limit, when this is very large, what you get here, you have a gap system, is nothing else but the reduced density operator. What will appear here will be and actually the operator corresponding to the maximum eigenvalue of your transfer matrix. And so there will be here some operator. So if you want to do it numerically, you will have to be able to calculate this operator. This operator actually lives in a very high dimensional space, so you will not be able to describe. But it turns out that now this operator here is nothing else than what I call sigma L. And the operator that you will have to contract from the right part is nothing else than sigma R. And I say that if the conjecture is true, then this operator can be written as e to the minus h prime, and this is written as e to the minus h prime, where this h prime is local. And Matt Hastings showed some time ago that if this is true, then you can describe this operator efficiently as a matrix product state. Efficiently meaning with your dimension of your tensors, which scales only polynomially with the number of particles that you have. So it means that you can approximate this in terms of a matrix product state. So then you can find, let's say, the eigenstates of your transfer matrix using matrix product state. But there is a method of doing that. This is this DMRG. So you can use DMRG to calculate this tensor. You can use DMRG to calculate this tensor independently. It's here. And at the end, you will have to contract these tensors. But these tensors can be contracted very easily, just from top to bottom, without increasing dimension efficiently. So again, so if it turns out that indeed this boundary theory for the auxiliary particles is local, as it seems to happen, at least for the examples that we have seen, this would mean that you can calculate efficiently the properties with PEPs in two dimensions. Okay, so summarizing. So I've been talking about PEPs. So a little bit the idea that we have behind these PEPs is that since all Hamiltonians which are local can be approximated, at least at any finite temperature, by PEPs, then when you talk about the states that appear in nature, then you can simply concentrate on PEPs because they will describe the properties of all the states that appear in nature. That's a little bit our approach, you know, why we study PEPs and the properties. We do condensed matter, let's say, with PEPs. So we concentrate on PEPs, and we see that for this family of states, PEPs, then there is a very clear relation between the bulk and boundary. You consider a region of spins. And this boundary is nothing else than these auxiliary particles that form these entangled pair states, which are living at the boundary where you cut your region. We have built an isometry that connects for these PEPs the bulk with the boundary. So any observable in the bulk can be mapped into an observable in a system of one dimension less, which is the boundary that is here. And in particular, the state, the reduced state of your bulk can be mapped into the reduced state of your boundary. The spectrum will be the same. And this explains why, at least for these systems, if you look at the spectrum of this, it looks like the spectrum of a one-dimensional system because it really corresponds to a one-dimensional system. In fact, for the AKLT model, this Hamiltonian that we find here actually is a Hamiltonian that corresponds to some conformal field theory. Now, numerically, we have seen that this Hamiltonian for your efficient theory at the boundary is local if your system is gap, and the quantum phase transition reflects itself by the fact that the Hamiltonian gets non-local, and that's very clear. So you have a local Hamiltonian, and you have e to the minus beta h at any finite temperature, then all correlation functions will decay exponentially. So there will be thermal length in your system, and so everything will decay exponentially. So you have local interactions here. There is no way that when you calculate expectation values in your original bulk system, you will get correlation functions that decay that have correlation length infinite. The only way of getting that the correlation length gets infinite is either that the temperature goes to zero or that the Hamiltonian gets non-local. And that's what we see, that the Hamiltonian gets non-local when you go to the phase transition where the correlation length goes to infinite. And then we have this remark that if this is true, so if in general or generically for gap systems, this effective Hamiltonian of the boundary is local, then this would be very good news because this would mean that we would have efficient algorithms at least to calculate expectation values for this system. Okay, thank you for your attention.
So what happens if you don't have translational invariance on the PEPs? Is that you still have the sesometry or?
Yes. Yes, okay. There's still an isometry. Yes. It would be more complicated, but it's an isometry one. Always. Because it just comes from the fact that you have auxiliary indices and you find the appropriate orthonormal basis for your spins and your auxiliary indices. So yeah, there is an isometry. So you can always map the bulk into the boundary whenever you have an anchor text.
I have a similar question. So what is specific of the geometry of the cylinder for the existence of this isometry? Because it seems like an
I mean I just took it because we can do numerical calculations here. But this is true for any geometry that you take. So you take any you could cut any part of your system, you can always build an isometry between the bulk and the boundary. Yes.
And also it didn't depend on the dimension, right?
What do you mean dimensions?
Well, this was, I mean, you were drawing, obviously, in two dimensions.
All right. So in three dimensions, it will go to two dimensions. Yeah, it's always, yeah.
Yeah. What, for instance, what, if you define an icing model on a book with all pages, if you, the boundary is then at the middle of the book. This one, is it possible to have an isometry?
Yes. Yes. So, but this isometry, of course, it will have many degrees of freedom.
When we are, let's say, cross the Spiel system, in one dimension, we can just do isomorphism model on a cross. It's two dimensions, we are set to play meeting on a common.
Yes, so it will. So, at the end, it will depend. So, when you make a cut of your region, so when you select what is your region, then it will scale like the boundary. And the coordination number. So if you have some complicated situation in which when you cut the boundary in some regions has more dimensions or less dimensions with a fractal dimension or whatever, then of course you will find that there is a mapping, but the mapping is not from two dimensions to one dimension, but to whatever dimension your region has. So this is just by construction.
This is true for any system that can be described by PEPs. So any system that can be described by PEPs is a system that can be described by the area law, is that correct?
Okay, that's a good question. It's not. I mean, it would be very happy if this would be like that. It's extremely happy. It made my life much simpler. But no, this is somehow true in one dimension for the moment. So it has been proven in one dimension that whenever you fulfill the area law or you violate Mali like logarithmic corrections, then you have an efficient description in terms of the one-dimensional version of PEPs, which is called matrix product state. That's true. In two dimensions, I believe that this is true. Maybe there are some specific cases where there is no true. There are some chiral theories which people say that it's not clear. But I would believe that it is so. But people have tried to prove that for a long time because this would mean basically that, there are two things that you would like to prove. First is the area law. This has not been proven in higher dimensions. And then you like to prove that if you fulfill the area law, then you can describe by PEPs. Because this will tell you that now you can describe all the states that appear in nature by PEPs. So this was the hope that people had, but at the moment this has not happened. But actually, Matt Hastings managed to prove it in a completely different way. So he forgot about the area law, and then he just looked at thermal states at any finite temperature. So he said, well, if I have a system with a local Hamiltonian, that's my bulk Hamiltonian, but don't confuse with the boundary Hamiltonian, the whole Hamiltonian for my system, and I have a thermostat at any finite temperature, I will write it like that. And then by manipulating this expression, he wrote that this is equal, or this can be approximated, to a PEPs with a purification. So it's basically a mixed PEP state for any finite beta. And so that's true.
That's for a gap Hamiltonian?
No, that's for any local. For any local Hamiltonian. So you can prove with Matt, Frank, and Michael Wall, we actually prove that for those systems, you can prove the area law if you work with the mutual information. So instead of using the entropy, you use the mutual information, then any state with local interactions at finite temperature then fulfills the area law with the mutual information. So there is something like that. But at the end, the connection was done not using the area law. So this is, that's the reason why what we say is that, okay, so this is true. So it means that instead of writing states in the computational basis and working with all these 2 to the n coefficients, then at the end, we work with one tensor, and we try to derive the physics from one tensor. So at the end, you have a topological theory, or you have gap phases, or you have, you know, some other string or the parameter, whatever property of your physical system, then you will be able to describe in terms of this tensor. So you have to develop a little bit the quantum mechanics in the language of this tensor, and that's actually what we are doing here.
So everything here was for nearest neighbor interactions.
Well, short-range interactions. Say finite range interactions. You can allow to have exponentially decaying interactions.
I just thought in terms of the tensors, even 1D, what if you had nearest neighbor and next to nearest neighbor? This will all still go through.
Yeah. So the interactions. So you have a Hamiltonian with such short-range interactions. So let's say that they have nearest neighbor and next to your neighbors. Then you can approximate it. If it's gap, you can always approximate it with a tensor of this form, just with near neighbor coupling efficiently. So you don't have to put more tensors. And the same thing with crossing two dimensions, at least at any finite temperature.
So given that the result holds regards to dimensionality of bulk, does this have implications for when you can contract tensors in a three-dimensional network?
Well, I mean, this will tell you. Actually, Hastings result it turns out that your tensor that you have to contract for this tensor network, you can write the tensor as corresponding to the transfer matrix of E to the minus beta H. Yes, you can contract it efficiently. Well, okay, it has to be careful. So what it means is that there you can use the MRG to contract the tensor. Okay, so so you know that there exists a description in terms of matrix product state, which somehow contracting your problem maps into finding that description. Now the second question is whether an algorithm is efficient in order to find this description, and that's a different story. That's a different story. So even in one dimension, this has not been proven. So let's say, for example, in one dimension, if I give you a Hamiltonian, then it may turn out that the ground state is a matrix product state, very simple, but to find it is very difficult. And in two dimensions, I mean, this happens everyday life because you have a thin glass, the ground state is a product state, but to find this is an hard problem. So one thing is that there exists a description, and so for this case, Hastings showed that there is a description, so you can contract the all tensor something which is simple, but maybe I mean, to find this simple tensor is difficult. What happens in DMRG is that for all cases that people find in practice, actually this contraction is efficient. And together with Norbert and also Dorit and some other people, I mean, wrote a paper in which we show that under certain conditions, actually you can certify that DMRG will find your ground state, but you have to find some scaling and things like that.
Oh, one question. So regarding your bulk and the boundary correspondence, is there any physical theory to determine the size of capital D in boundary?
Well, this is the one that corresponds to your PEPs. So you start
Yes, I know this corresponds. So if you like to somehow improve the approximation, then you have to go to the larger D.
Exactly. So the idea, I mean, the typical problem that people study condensed matter is somebody gives you a Hamiltonian, that's a Hamiltonian for the whole system. And from here, you would like to have a sufficient description, and the PEPs will give you an efficient description. So here, from here, this is what you would like to find your tensor. And the claim is that the dimension of this tensor, of this boundary, is D, what I call D, goes poly, like poly, with the size of your system.
Yeah, I know that. I'm wondering whether, you know, for example, if you're starting from the bulk Hamiltonian, if you know some property like the two-point correlation function, the correlation length, and the, can you put some reasonable bound for this? I think this is the boundary theory is totally virtual, or is this kind of still the physical object?
So the not that I know, because you see, you can have very simple tensors with small dimension 2, which have infinite correlation length or zero correlation length. You can also have theories that are not gap, that have zero correlation length, very short correlation length. So there is a very large variety. So I'm not sure how to find this D if you give me the Hamiltonian.
Okay, so let's thank you.